'Tis the season for ghosts and goblins. And no, I'm not talking about politicians. It's all part of the fun on Halloween. And then there are the haunted houses meant to scare the devil out of you. But there are also real haunted houses and buildings and places that are inhabited year-round, or so it's rumored, by the souls of the departed. Columbus is full of them. Here to tell us about some of these spirited spaces are Tom Betty and Doreen Juha-Sauer from the Columbus Landmarks Foundation. They co-wrote a book, Historic Columbus Taverns, the Capital City's Most Storied Saloons, which devoted a chapter to haunted taverns. The Columbus Foundation also organized a series of haunted tours again this year, and Tom and Doreen has organized a series of tours to the haunted taverns as well, and we'll hear about all of that with them. Welcome, Tom and Doreen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Question for our listeners. Do you believe in ghosts? Do you ever think you've seen one? Give us a call and share your stories. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go to our Facebook page and post your comment there as well. If you have any questions about the tours, of course, you're welcome to call us and post your question. Doreen and Tom, most of the tours are sold out or finished by now, at least, but your Haunted Historic Taverns tours have a couple more dates already available now, and it's going to go forward. Doreen, tell us about that.
Well, our things are selling out very quickly, and so we are actually looking forward to another series starting in January. So I think historic tavern tours that are haunted will continue into the new year as part of a year-round offering, just as they do in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and Boston and other big cities. We've hit the big time.
And when you do the haunted tours to the taverns, there's that added benefit, right, Tom, of a little bit of drink and food along the way?
Oh, absolutely. We want people to have fun. I mean, we do this very tongue-in-cheek. If anyone knows Doreen and I, nothing ever happens to us. And, you know, we only believe in ghosts in October because it's a good opportunity to tell these stories. But we want people to have fun. We want them to be entertained. And we also want to teach them a little bit about our city's history.
I was reading about the Kelton House. And I guess I've known that it's been considered haunted before. But I really, you know, read about it this time. And it's kind of amazing the enduring, how the stories have endured. What do people see, Doreen, or what do they hear about, or what are the stories about the Kelton House?
Well, what's kind of interesting about this is Columbus Landmarks Foundation as an organization is 35 years old, and I think we've been doing these tours probably almost for 30 years, and they really did start about Town Street and the number of houses on that street that were haunted that we found out about quite by accident. We were not looking for this at all. And it centered around the Kelton House because they did not want those stories told. They were facing a bridal business, the Junior League were establishing a historic house museum, and then years passed, I assumed that they were telling stories, put it in print in a freelance article, and at that point it was kind of out there. And we were actually told by Kelton for years, you can stop in front of the house in a bus or you can walk by it. It's never to be in print, and you know,
and they'll never let you in the house.
They'll never let us in. And since then, of course, now everything is open and the stories just continue to proliferate depending on the house manager, the people that are there, the kinds of changes. So, and it turns out that some of those were going on while Grace Kelton was still alive. So, very old stories.
And you have to keep in mind that the Kelton House is a fine example of American history, and it's extremely rare to find a house that's almost 95% intact with everything from four generations from the 1850s. So it's such a treasure in Columbus, you know, outside of the ghost stories. Mm-hmm. But there's so many weird things that happen there that makes it a very entertaining, you know, to tell, you know, some of the stories that have happened.
My guests are Tom Betty and also Doreen Juha-Sauer. They're both members of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, and we're talking about haunted places in Columbus. If you have a haunting story, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's talk a little bit about Kelton. It was an important stop on the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. We know it was a stop because of two little girls who were dropped off there. How active it was and if there were others affected, we really don't have a way of dealing or knowing that. But they have created an underground railroad learning station downstairs, and they're just wonderfully good about trying to get that out, that story out in Columbus.
And is Kelton House, is it important because of how it's been maintained intact the way it is, Tom? Or were there other
I would say all of the above. Uh-huh. It's an extraordinary example of all the different time periods since 1850 to the 1970s. And it's been fully restored. You have artifacts in there that are you know, for instance, the Victorians must have had a lot of time on their hands. And they like to make jewelry out of hair. So there are several artifacts in there from the Kelton family that you know, jewelry made of human hair, which, you know, we find kind of repulsive now, but it was very accepted and in Victorian times.
So if they go to the – does the tour stops at the Kelton House, right?
Well, we have several tours, and one of the bus tours, a stop is at Thurber House and at Kelton, and then a bed and breakfast in Victorian Village, which is extremely active. When we do walking tours, the route may change depending on if we're – on Town Street or we're in German Village or we're in another neighborhood. So each season, we probably have a variety of 3 to 4 different types of tours.
Have either of you ever seen anything or felt anything?
Well, I have to tell you, every season we've had the Kelton House on tour, something has happened, not necessarily to Tom and I. I think Tom and I have been Teflon. You know, the ghost goes out and takes
they avoid
a
us. You know,
takes a
slumber again.
The crazy historians are coming.
It's time to go to White Castle. And but yeah, the other night, a woman was taking a photo, and people do that to see if they can get orbs. And Tom happened to be in the corner of the photo, just kind of with his back turned, and yet another figure appeared. And when we showed it to one of the docents, she said, "Well, I'm not sure. There are just two people." And we said, "Yeah, that's the point. There's only one." And there was clearly a person sitting in a chair in a dark kind of morning outfit. And it was not a docent. No one else was in the room. So,
and I immediately said, if my mom's listening, I'm going back to church.
That is kind of creepy. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Yes, I can't say that this is in Columbus, but there was a house, and I'm pretty sure it was reported on KET, Kentucky Educational TV, in Russellville or Russell, Kentucky, and it's I don't know if you want to call it haunted, but it's close to it. The story is, just real quick, that there was a lady, a young lady, who was very angry, and she was very angry one night when there was a lightning storm, and she was raising her fist and was very angry up in this tower. And I don't know exactly if the lightning got her or if she just died or died of unnatural consequences or something, but she died. But when they went up there and stuff, and later on, they saw in the glass in the window of the tower she was standing in a figure of her etched in the glass. And this has been reported not only by KET, but a broadcaster a long time ago named Stan Matlock here on Cincinnati TV, radio.
But you've never seen it.
No, I haven't been, but they say that after the figure appeared, they took out the glass, and the figure reappeared in the new glass. They painted it over, and the figure is still in that. And needless to say, I don't think anybody's allowed in. I haven't been anywhere near Russellville, Kentucky, but this has been a story that's been carried around a bit.
Interesting. Don, Doreen?
I think it's wonderful when people call in and tell us stories because we've learned so much more from people. And in fact, stories that have come into us, I love angry women's stories. stories that have come into us, we have been very careful never to tell the exact location because that is a private home. But what we found was anger is around a lot of these. And especially homes in German Village and Victorian Village in the 1980s, when there was a lot of renovation going on and time and effort, of people suddenly uncovering that there was something wanted out of the house. There's a disembodied green phosphorus and head that screams but never makes a sound in a shotgun house in German Village. There's a woman who cries out in the attic on a house on Yale Avenue that was actually even owned by a cabinet member of Dana Reinhart. It's cabinet mayor Reinhart.
Former mayor, yeah.
Yes. And so these stories are just they're just wonderful. And what's actually come out of it is the homeowner screams back and says, you can't stay here. We've got kids. They've got to be in bed by 11. You're going to stop screaming. And the thing goes away, you know. So angry, angry people fighting back.
People too. Don, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Patrick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
I actually was on an Indian reservation in Wyoming, the Wind River Reservation, about 10 years ago. I was staying out there for a few months, and it was, I suppose late in the evening. I was watching television, and the person I was staying with had gone to bed. And behind me, I feel her walking, like coming up to say something. So I turn around to talk to her, and there's no one there. But the steps continue straight out the door. And that's just happening while I'm sitting there watching. And I was just kind of mortified at the moment. I wasn't quite sure what to do. And the next morning, I tell her, you know, what had happened. She says, oh, yeah, there was a, she just says it like it's no big thing. There was a spirit in my room. I told it to get out. And I just never knew quite what to make of that.
You never asked her if she knew the spirit or?
No, well, it's pretty, at least out there, it's pretty common. There's a lot of stories about just about every part of the reservation. So, I mean, to her, it was part and parcel of living life out there.
All right. Well, thanks, Patrick.
All right. Take care.
One of the, well, let's talk a little bit about the haunted taverns. The elevator, again, was another example. The elevator, the restaurant, which is still in operation on High Street downtown, was an example of an angry person.
Right. And I think that's interesting how stories from certain time periods sort of fall into different genres, and there are some that are definitely folklore, and others that are sort of the urban legend that come out with college campuses, and then there are the ones where there seem to be something that definitely is repeating itself. So the elevator falls into sort of that early folklore and an era in which a tavern is a real man's world. And the elevator was definitely the man's world. And the woman who appears at the back bar, at the back door, who's obviously scantily clad, perhaps had been upstairs, had been jilted by the Colonel Pritchard, who was the man's man at the back door, and she stabs him in the heart, in an instant.
And this really happened. We know that.
It seems to have really happened. And then it's her footprints that appear in the snow going outside the door. That part, of course, is always the vengeful woman. And for many years, there was a figure above at the bar called the Venging Woman, and then it disappeared. So I don't know. You know, maybe maybe she packed up and decided to, you know, take her vengeance elsewhere.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about haunted places in Columbus. If you know a haunted place, give us a call, 614-292-8513. With me, Tom Betty, and also Doreen Juha-Sauer, both members of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, marijuana on the ballot again next week for medical use, for recreational use. We'll look at the country's changing take on pot. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. A chance of rain and snow this morning, then rain likely this afternoon, a high of 45. A little bit of a rain-snow mix tonight, a low of 36 degrees. And then a slight chance of rain on Thursday, and we could see some sunshine peeking through on Thursday, with a high of 50. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More details about the programs and upcoming information sessions are online at glenn.osu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
¶¶ We're talking about haunted places in Columbus. If you have a story to share, give us a call, 614-292-8513. This time of year, the Columbus Landmarks Foundation organizes a series of haunted tours. They're sold out, and they're pretty much done for the year. But with us, Tom Betty and Doreen Juha-Sauer from the foundation, we're still talking about those places. And also, they have co-written a book. It's called Historic Columbus Taverns, the capital city's most storied saloons. And I guess from writing that book, that's how you learned about all the haunted taverns, Doreen?
Well, we had been collecting these stories over time, so we really had a lot more background about German and Irish immigrants and their taverns, much more a straight history, and then the stories just kind of fold in and neatly layer in.
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My name's Jim, and I have a friend in West Lafayette, Indiana, who purchased a house several years ago. And the house was supposedly haunted. The wife of the family sent a picture of the house to a painter and asked her to paint a picture of the house. And several weeks went by, and so the resident calls up and asks, when's my picture going to be finished? And she says, well, I'm having a problem. There's one area that I just can't figure out. So she calls her. She goes over there, and there's a lot of trees around the house, and where the leaves are not, there's clearly a ghost. And she said, that picture's perfect, and it still hangs at their house. And if you go there and you say to somebody, look at that picture and tell me what's wrong with it, and you go right to it, you see the ghost. And it's where the leaves are not painted, the white space. Kind of neat story.
Yeah. Interesting. Is that in Columbus?
No, that's in West Lafayette, Indiana.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Jim. I don't know why,
but
each one of these stories kind of does give me the creeps.
one of the things we found out, because one year we organized a symposium and invited the editors of Old House Journal to come and talk about the letters they get from people renovating, and these are unsolicited. And it was quite interesting, but from that we learned other things. I don't think there's... And I'd love to be corrected on this, a documented history of a mobile home that's haunted. We also found out that ghosts tend not to move from one place to another unless there is a moving van and trunks used. So the old ghosts at Players Theater stayed. They didn't move to the Vern Rife Center. And generally, cemeteries aren't haunted because if you think about it, that's not where most people would want to keep their energy. I have a friend who talks about this. It's like Shakespeare, all the world's a stage, and we're all having competing performances, and occasionally the veil lifts between the performances. So,
The old Players Theater was haunted?
The old Players Theater was haunted by a gentleman who would always be the gopher and make sure everything was right, and then before each performance started, he would ring a gong. And then in times of crisis, he was the guy to go to. But when he died, he still managed to get the costumes out and find the lost articles and whatnot. But I don't think he made the journey to the Vern Rife Center.
Okay. Simone in Akron, you're on the air. Welcome, Simone.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
This is mostly a ghost story. It doesn't have to do with a house in Columbus. I'm from Akron, Ohio. And my father, this was in my father's old house. He said when he died, he would give us a sign, me and my family a sign. So one day in the old house, my mother and I were sitting at the dining room table, and there was a cookie jar in between us. And as we were talking and looking at each other, the lid of the cookie jar flew up in the air, and we watched it. And then it fell down to the floor, as if someone picked it up, threw it up in the air, and then it fell to the floor. So we both looked at each other and said, oh, that's Dad giving us a sign.
Did you believe in ghosts before that?
Oh, yes. My great-grandmother always talked about grandfather walking up the stairs. My great-grandmother... And we would actually hear at one point during the night someone walking up the stairs. She terrified us. But then I said to myself, there must be something to this. And years later, I read somewhere that family members who pass away will come back and contact other family members on the other side.
Okay. So, all right. Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Thank you.
Take care. If you have a story to share, 614-292-8513. Did you want to add something, Doreen?
Well, as I say, I love these stories because they do kind of help build to see patterns in things. And there is a house on 2nd Avenue, which we never disclosed the location of, which for almost 30 years has exhibited this kind of activity. The family who originally lived there thought they heard a marching band in the middle of the night. And I live in the university area, and that could be any night, you know, in my life. But they came downstairs, and the rug had been rolled up and put behind the couch. And they had all sorts of other activities. When she mentioned the cookie jar, it was a sugar bowl in their case. They couldn't keep it on the table. It would just keep flying off and flying off. They've tried renting the house, and over periods of time, and the house is still
haunted. I was
going to
say how often people stay in a house after they know it's haunted, or maybe some of the tavern owners over the years have said, I'm tired of this, or it gives them the creeps or something, and they want to get rid of the bar. Does you ever hear about that?
I don't know. I think people develop a bond, don't you, Tom, with the creatures?
Especially the bed and breakfast that we feature. You know, she almost has a friendship with these spirits that are in the house. The one spirit was a smoker and died of lung cancer, and he evidently still smokes in the house, and she smells smoke, and, you know, she yells at him, Cedric, you know, quit your smoking, and, you know, they protect her. It's a very interesting story that she shares with us.
Michael in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, how are you guys?
Very well.
I'm pretty much a ghost skeptic, but my mom really believes in them, and she told me stories while I was a little boy about a boy in Cleveland, a ghost orb or whatever you want to call it, that was holding her hand during the nighttime and things like that. It never converted me to really believe, but I certainly just kind of had a healthy, like, hey, I'll just kind of experience for myself, see what my life shows me. Nothing really concrete. I'll tell you one thing. My sister was in Woodbridge, Virginia, and I came to visit her. And she told me she had haunted woods behind her house, and she thought that it was from Civil War ghosts. And I was like, okay, wow, that's great. And that evening, we were barbecuing, and kind of the night fell, and we started to hear yelling, like actual yelling and kind of chaos kind of coming from these dark woods. Nobody was in them. And it gave me the chills, made the hair on my neck stand up. I won't say it converted me to believe in them wholeheartedly, but it definitely opened my eyes, like, you know, something's doing that. I just can't quite tell why. Is it wind? You know, trying to make the explanations for it. But I'm still kind of on the fence. I don't see how ghosts get physical. Like you said, the rug was rolled up and smoke. You know, if they're a spirit, how can they do physical acts on with, you know, earthly things like a rug?
You're a scientist. I mean, it doesn't wash with the science, right?
I guess you're right.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I mean, exactly. It's it doesn't make sense. So, well, Michael, thanks. You gave me the creeps.
Sorry.
You passed.
That was a great Halloween.
It's okay. I want people out there to give me the creeps today. Thanks again. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a ghost story, share it. That's what we're talking about today with Tom Betty and also Doreen Juha-Sauer. They're both members of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, and we've been talking about different haunted locations in Columbus. They have haunted tours during the Halloween season every year, and they also have a haunted tavern, haunted historic tavern tour that continues throughout the year now, as long as there's a demand for it. There'll be more in, there's a few more coming up in the next week or so. We'll have a website on our at our website at wosu.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. Doreen, you did mention during the break that a lot of the ghost stories are wrapped up, particularly in Columbus, wrapped up in the pre-Civil War period when so many of the recruits had come to Columbus to train.
Yeah, when you think about it, Columbus is only about 18,000 people before the Civil War, and then suddenly triples after the Civil War. It's a major recruiting depot for the Union, and there were a lot of Southern sympathizers. So you have a lot of young men coming into a town, a lot of looking for the last night, you know, when Tom mentioned Bordello before, attached the jury room, this idea that morals sort of decline would not be out of keeping. In addition, there are things we just don't know. One of the earliest haunted stories I heard from a woman on a bus by herself took me aside to tell me was that as a child she played in Livingston Park Playground, which is essentially the playground in front of Children's Hospital. And as a little girl living in the neighborhood saw a woman passing through the trees who she assumed was really there, and then realized that the woman wasn't when the woman looked up and she disappeared, and went home and told her mother, and her mother said, then you have the sight, because that happened to me when I was a child. And would people forget that? There's a cemetery there. There are 75 Confederate soldiers still buried under that playground because their bodies were never found to take them over to Camp Chase. And so we have forgotten cemeteries under Columbus State, you know, at North Market, places like this. And they give rise to those kinds of stories that seem to travel through generations. And I think there are a lot of Civil War stories yet to be discovered.
Anne in New Albany, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You owned a haunted house yourself.
I did. I used to own a home in Cleveland, in a suburb of Cleveland. The home was built in 1928, and I had two dogs at the time who, in the basement of the house, would stand and face one of the corners and bark at the wall incessantly. There was nothing there that I could see, but they frequently were very disturbed by something in the corner of that room. Sometime later, I had a friend come and stay at the house. The dog sat while I was traveling, and she was not aware of my thought that maybe the house was haunted. And she had an experience where she was in the bedroom alone and suddenly could smell men's cologne, very strong, and she could see shadows walking in the hallway underneath the door. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that perhaps there really was a spirit there.
Yeah, so did you sell the house and get out of there or what?
Well, I did ultimately sell the house, but not because of that. So, yes. But, yeah, and I had another experience in Cleveland as well when I was exercising, walking in a park, and felt someone push me, even though I was by myself. I mean, physically was pushed backwards, like someone shoved me in the chest. And I was with a friend, a different friend, and she saw it happen. There was nobody there, but I was literally physically pushed backwards. And I don't know what that was about, but I've often thought that was maybe a spirit as well.
All right. Maybe you have the vision. I don't know. But, Anne, thanks for sharing that story.
Thanks.
Yeah. Take care. I want to grab one more, but before I do, Tom or Doreen, do animals play a role?
Yeah, animals can see things. You know, I can't explain it. You know, I've actually brought my dog along on some of these, and he doesn't see anything. I mean, all he wants to do is be petted, but... but there are several stories of, especially, you know, at the bed and breakfast in the Short North, where her dogs will run around, you know, chasing something and then, you know, get all scared and run away obviously they could see something. Do animals have a sixth sense? You know, perhaps.
Jim in Urbana, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Actually, it's Richard.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Good morning, Anne and Tom and Doreen. I have three quick stories. The first one, I was quite a young student in high school, and we went to a friend's house, and they told us it was a haunted house, but of course we didn't believe them. And we were walking down the basement steps, and along the wall there were brooms and mops hanging on the wall. And by the time we reached the bottom of the steps, these brooms and mops started jumping off their rack and down the steps towards us. Of course, we were frightened to death and ran immediately out of the house and laughed about it, but it still sent a chill up your spine. And the next story, I was also a senior in high school, and we had a seance at a home on Morris Road in Springfield. And when the medium asked if there was a spirit in the room to please show themselves, the wallpaper tore from the roof of the room down to the floor. And, of course, there again, the kids screamed and ran out of the room, and the medium said, wait, please don't disturb them. Well, of course, that was the end of the seance.
It was too late by then, yeah, okay.
And my final story I was a cook for the Girl Scouts of Lake Erie Girl Scout Council outside of Cleveland. And they have two camps side by side at Lake Julia Kroll and Lake or Camp Hyleka. And I was a cook for the camp at Julia Kroll, but my cabin was at Camp Hyleka, which was the old Kirby estate. And there's a mansion there, and there's a pond with a mill house. And my cabin was just a few yards from the mill house. And I had to walk 2 miles from my cabin up to the Camp Julia Kroll to do my cooking. Well, one evening, it was a beautiful night, and I'm not sure whether it was a full moon, but it was certainly a bright moon. And as I was walking down the path to my cabin, I happened to look over at the mill house. And on the balcony of the mill house stood a black woman in a tattered dress, and just stood there. And I can tell you the hair on the back of my neck stood straight up. I ran to my cabin and locked the door. Of course, if it was a ghost, I'm sure it could come right in. But when I got to camp to cook the next day, and I told the story to the camp director, and she said, "You are absolutely not the first person to see that spirit, that it's a recurring thing." And so it was just kind of a reassurance. And since then, I have become an active spiritualist.
Okay.
And I do believe in the spirit world, and I do believe that we have connections with the spirit world.
Okay.
And
hey, you know, Richard,
you know,
we're almost out of time. I just wanted to say thank you for your story, though.
Well, thank you
for
having me.
We appreciate it. You bet. Take care. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Is that very typical that a proprietor, say at the bed and breakfast that you were talking about, doesn't tell people about these things and waits for the stories to come back?
Yes, that's her policy. She does not advertise. And when she's making breakfast in the morning, you know, she just waits for the stories. And usually one person will say, you know, was someone trying to break into my room or rattling the doorknob? And then that usually is the opening. But one thing I want to point out, you know, I may be a skeptic about all of these ghosts and spirits, but from the stories that we have heard, that ghosts and spirits don't necessarily need to be, evil spirits.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of good stories that we hear and funny stories that we hear. For instance, Grace Kelton is apparently still at the Kelton House, and she has a wicked sense of humor.
For example,
there's a bathtub that is upstairs, and she likes to. A medium said that she likes to stand there naked and laugh at people.
Oh my god!
And if you ever saw a picture of Grace Kelton
in
her later days when she was in her 80s. I'm sure it's a sight to see, but I'm glad I can't see those things.
Well, thanks for helping us depart from the world of the real world of politics for a few minutes today. Tom Betty and Doreen Juha-Sauer of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, we've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to the listeners for all your great stories. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody. Maybe next year. And we'll have links for those who are interested to the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, if you're interested in the tours next year or upcoming the Haunted Tavern tours, which Doreen and Tom lead. When we return, back to politics. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The first Tuesday in November, just around the corner, Superstorm Sandy put a stop to the top of the tippet campaigning, but as water recedes and lights come back on, the Obama and Romney campaigns will rev up for the home stretch. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, Anna Greenberg, and Matt Continetti join us for the countdown to Election Day. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay with us in just about 20 minutes, starting at 11 o'clock. It's Hour 2 of All Sides, the pros and cons of Ohio Issue 2. That discussion at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 40 degrees in downtown Columbus with rain today, a high of 45. A chance of rain and snow tonight, a low of 36 degrees. There's a slight chance of rain and then gradually becoming sunny on Thursday with a high of 50. And partly cloudy Thursday night, a low of 33 degrees. More sunshine for Friday and a high near 50. Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. As a sustainer, the gift can be a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card. Then your membership is always active and your member card renews automatically. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up today. And support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern University. Saturday, November 3rd is Discover ONU Day, allowing visiting students to learn about the blend of liberal arts and professional programs offered at ONU. Registration is open through October 31st, online at onu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It seems like every 4 years, journalists from around the world converge on one location, cameras cocked and ready, to see who wins. We're not talking about the Olympics or who takes the gold. Rather, we're talking about presidential election and who takes Ohio. Okay, you say that's their job. That's what journalists are paid to do. But wait, there's more. What may surprise you is that people pay to visit the Buckeye State as political tourists to see firsthand why Ohio is so important in presidential politics. The name of the company is called Political Tours, and the director of the company is a former New York Times correspondent, Nicholas Wood. He's with us today. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Also with us is one of the consultants that Nicholas worked with to produce this tour, to plan the tour, and he's an All Sides with Ann Fisher regular, our political analyst, Bill Hershey. Welcome, Bill.
Oh, thanks, Ann. It's always good to be here.
So I guess the first question has to be, who in the world goes on these tours? Who are you taking on this tour, which starts today, by the way?
We set up the company really as a vehicle for people who have got a strong interest in news and current affairs. So instead of just listening to the radio or reading the newspaper, we cut out the middleman, enable you to actually go and look at a situation yourself. We go to places as diverse as the City of London, North Korea. We've been to Libya this year, the Balkans. So we're trying to pick key issues in current affairs and then give people an opportunity to actually go there on the ground and assess the situation for themselves. The kind of people we get are very diverse. They're from their 20s to their 80s. Quite a few of them are sort of professional in background, but then we've had people who have sold tiles for a living or sell cheese, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to sort of pigeonhole them, but they're all gripped by politics. And when they hear about this concept, they're very taken and they want to try it out.
Yeah, there is a trend toward more active vacations where people aren't just laying around doing nothing. They want to do something. Either maybe it's volunteer work or something like that. Archaeological digs are popular, or people think they're popular. Is that sort of what you're thinking about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, also, I thought that you can have history tours, you can have art history tours, that more of these sort of niche sector tours that are educational. And it seemed to me, you know, a really obvious question: why didn't you have a political tour out there? And I used to have friends who came out and visited me when I worked in the Balkans, and they really, really enjoyed it when I showed them around and gave them a tour of the place, which was very political. And I remember one time I had to drive from Slovenia down to Kosovo, and it's a distance of about sort of 650 miles, and I had to do it in less than a day. And I just went to the local youth hostel, and there was a guy from California there. And he said he wanted to go to Zagreb or Dubrovnik. And I said, forget Zagreb. You don't want to go to Zagreb. You want to go to Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. And he said, yeah, okay, I'll try it out. And so he shared the driving and he came down for 3 days. And that was just before Kosovo declared independence. And the guy it had a huge impact on him. And I'd already had this idea in the back of my mind. And so I thought, well, look, if it works with people like him, this is going to work anyway.
Well, no offense to Ohio, but that area of the world is very beautiful, too. I mean, the drive itself must have been beautiful. In Ohio, you really have to get off the beaten path to see Hocking Hills and some really beautiful places in the state of Ohio. But that's not what you're going to take people to see. They're really going to be on the they're going to be in places, but it's not about beautiful, natural.
We're trying to see how this place ticks. I mean, Ohio is in the position of being the pivotal state in a crucial election. And it affects the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is concerned because you have an impact on our lives. Mm-hmm. And so this is really bizarre that we want to know what's going on in a local community and how that can affect the world. So we go and visit farmers who are worried about the drought or the farming bill or the estate tax. And that all has an impact on the election and then filters out into the rest of the world. And so you have people who want to come with us and really drill down to politics at a very local level. We go and visit local churches. We go and see the auto workers up in Cleveland. We're going to spend time with some polling experts in Dayton, the bellwether, within a bellwether. Mm-hmm. So people really get to grips with local issues and see how that sort of filters up into the bigger picture.
Bill Hershey, when you were asked to consult on this, how did you approach it? Because it's a very different way of looking at our state in a way.
It is, but Nicholas had an idea of the types of people and places he wanted to go. And this is the first presidential campaign I haven't covered actively in Ohio since 1980. So I just thought of the different types of places and people that I always talked to who had an impact on the election. Now, I told Nicholas I never had covered much in the farming sector of the Ohio economy. But, you know, from the State House, people like Joe Cornelli who are in touch with farmers, and I knew it was the state's biggest industry, most impact on the economy. And so I just started going through my list of people that related to the topics he was interested in. And you find that just like as a reporter, when you start talking to people, they want to talk to you. So when I explained what we were doing, many of them said, oh, that sounds like an interesting idea. Let's give that a try.
Have you done tours like this in the United States before?
This is our first one.
Okay.
And it's not just about the election. It's really about where American politics is headed. And as an outsider, I'm often shocked by how partisan politics in the States has become. And so in a way, it's trying to get to the roots of that. Why is there such a deep division? We spoke to a farmer the other day, and he said to us, I'm worried about America becoming Europe. And for me, that was like a pretty sort of startling statement. You know, what did he mean by that? But I want to know, what are his fears? Why does he think that with the continuation of Obama in power, that the country really is going to be run into the ground? It's something I want to know more about.
Are most of the people on this trip, are they from Europe?
No, we've got a mix. We've got a couple of people from Australia and then the rest from the UK.
And there, in many ways, nothing could be more dissimilar to, especially in the UK, how elections are run. They seem to be constant 24/7, 365. Now, Bill, I don't know, since 1980, I know since 1990 when I've been covering them, it never was like this. There used to be a beginning and an end, and now it's almost constant.
Well, you can bet November 7th, the 2016 presidential campaign will start, no matter who wins.
Right. And so how do you kind of embrace all of that? And then also the fact that we really only have two parties in this country that are viable when it comes to getting elected president. I did a show yesterday with third-party candidates. They're certainly out there, but nothing like you have in Europe and the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the interesting thing, is how can you have these parties are very broad churches, and how do you bring in all these different interest groups into to one sector? And you go into these communities, and you see there are actually quite big divisions within them. But when it comes to election day, they seem to rally around together. But it does come I think the really interesting trend for me is to see what's happening with the Republican Party at the moment, and how Mitt Romney has pulled back into the centre ground. In order to become the candidate, he had to appeal to the right wing for the Tea Party, and now he's appealing to the centre ground to get elected.
In the UK, can politicians do that? And do they do that to one degree or another?
I guess they do, but I don't know. I have to sort of apologize for saying it, but it sometimes seems that politics here is reduced to really simplistic terms, and there's not much space for complicated, more nuanced debate, and that sometimes I find that a bit shocking.
Yeah, I was listening to some of the third party debate to prepare for my show earlier this week, Bill Hershey, and it was really interesting.
I always used to like to interview the third party candidates because they would drill down into the issues, what they would do if they were elected. But I never was able to spend too much time interviewing them or writing about them because I could get no space for the stories about them. And except 1992, remember Ross Perot?
Right, of course.
That was a difference in that. Probably Ross Perot's entrance in that race probably helped Bill Clinton become president because Bill Clinton won Ohio. But that's the exception, not the rule. And maybe a little bit in 2000 with Ralph Nader and affecting Gore's results.
Nicholas Wood, how has the hurricane and how has the moving target of this election, because now, of course, Obama, at least there's a poll up where he's up five percentage points now versus a dead heat. And, you know, that could change from day to day anyways at this point. But particularly, how has the hurricane affected what you're doing? Because you're going to be ending up in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say we've lost we've got three people coming in late because their flights have been canceled. But, I mean, that's in the big overall scheme of things that, you know, we can cope with that. And obviously the bigger issue is what's happened to people out on the East Coast. It's the uncertainty surrounding the election has made it much more interesting, and I have to thank the president for the first debate because it seemed a lot more clear cut over the first. And you know, Ohio didn't seem that big a deal beforehand, but it's made it that much more intense and that much more interesting. But again, I want to repeat, this is not just about what the results of this election. It's really about trying to get to grips in some way with American society and American politics and where it's heading.
Ohio, was that an obvious choice for you right off the bat? Or did it seem originally like, oh, Washington, D.C.?
No, I mean, we clearly wanted to get away from the East Coast. It doesn't represent American politics, preferably somewhere in the Midwest. And we're on the edge of the Midwest here. But the key thing is that it's got a great representation of American society. So you've got the rural, the urban, the demographics of touch all the key issues. So within a small area, you can really explore a lot of issues, and that's really what we try and do. Whatever country we go to, is we try and do a cross section of society, from people right down, poor people right on the ground, to politicians, to analysts, and group it all together to tell a more complex story of what's going on.
How much does it cost?
Our tours cost started around £2,500, which is about $3,300. Mm-hmm. This one costs more. Your hotels and particularly your transport here in Ohio is very, very expensive, I have to say.
It's a big state. Things are far apart.
I think there's fewer suppliers of the type of transport he wants to have also.
So that's just a minor complaint.
Something to note.
Yeah.
No mass transit, of course, across the state.
No what?
No mass transit across the state.
No, that's right. I mean, in other countries, quite happy to jump on a train between one city and another, and that suits us very well. But I appreciate our tours are expensive for a lot of ordinary people. But I mean, it's partly because there's a lot of time and a lot of effort that goes into it and a lot of people involved.
Something you wrote or something I read about political tours said that some of the people that go on them are in business. They're business people and they want to learn more about a country where they're going to be doing business and that sort of thing. Is that the case on this tour?
Not on this particular one. We've got people who are involved in politics and have been involved in politics, and who this is a way in. This is a way of trying to get to grips with issues in a deeper way. Often we have academics as well who come and do that. But yeah, but increasingly businesses, if you're looking at a developing market, say Turkey, for example, you don't know how that country works. It's a way of really seeing a cross-section of society and seeing the key trends.
So, Bill Hershey, who did you pick for folks to meet and what to see in Columbus?
Well, tonight we're going to have dinner with Herb Asher, the veteran political scientist from Ohio State who's analyzed presidential elections for a long time. And then on Thursday we're going to talk with Joe Rugola, the former Ohio AFL-CIO president who's with the Ohio Association of Public School Employees and had a big role in defeating State Issue 2 last year, the public employee union issue. And after that, we're scheduled to meet with Democratic Chairman Chris Redfern, Republican Chairman Bob Bennett.
At the same time?
No,
okay.
Back to back.
That would be something.
Mr. Bennett's coming down from Cleveland, okay. So we're hoping he'll make it here. And then it's off to a farm in Richland County. The farmer's name slipped my mind right now.
Mike Cook.
Fifth generation.
He's fifth generation. Very interesting family.
And then tonight, if we make it, we're going to be at the University of Akron for a mano-mano duel between Jerry Austin, the Democrat, and Mark Weaver, the Republican consultant.
Nice.
And I think John Green will sort of be the moderator. With a class of students at the University of Akron, it's campaign battleground class. And I think there'll be a good cross-section of students in there, and there's supposed to be another consultant. Then after that, I hope we sleep before we get to start again the next day.
Who told you that, Bill?
I don't know.
I was going to say. Well, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Nicholas Wood, if the tourists get a chance to really talk with Ohioans, or do they observe and just listen to what they
absolutely.
Say?
Absolutely. The whole point is that they're briefed by people who really know the situation. Then they actually get to sit down with ordinary people. We go to people's homes. We sit down and we ask, you know, where does your income come from? How are you earning living? What are your hopes? So it's really, really grassroots, and they really do have access to people.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Nicholas Wood, he's director of political tours. It kicks off today. The political tour of Ohio kicks off today in Columbus. And also Bill Hershey, veteran statehouse and Washington reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
As Gemma, the fierce old lady of the biker gang in the FX series Sons of Anarchy, Katie Sagal has shot and killed people, pulled a gun on a baby, and other horrible things.
She's done quite a few. What, you know, might be viewed as heinous, but she does not view them that way.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Katie Sagal. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media. 40 degrees in downtown Columbus with rain today, a high of 45. Rain mixing with snow tonight, just a little bit, and a low of 36. Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, exploring the beauty and complexity beneath your skin with Gunther Van Hagen's Body Worlds, The Brain, now at COSI for a limited time. Presented by Ohio Health. More at cosi.org/bodyworlds. And this is 89.7 NPR News. It's 11 o'clock.
Most voters would have to check their voter registration card to identify their legislative or congressional district. Most of them, for that matter, are lucky to name their state or congressional representatives. But by many measures, those are the lawmakers that matter the most. That's why control of the so-called redistricting process is so important. Issue 2 on the November ballot is asking voters to change who controls that process, from elected officials to an appointed commission. Coming up, we'll hear the pros and cons of Issue 2. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.